Welcome to the deep dive. We're going straight into the source material today. We're really trying to bypass the broader historical narratives to focus on a kind of pure forensic analysis.
That's right.
Our mission is pretty direct. We want to unpack the detailed recurring patterns and the specific tactics used in Joseph Smith's plural marriage
And
proposals.
we aren't here to discuss belief. I mean, that's not the point. We're here to analyze the mechanics of power.
Exactly. We're moving beyond the simple fact that polygamy existed in Nauvoo, and we're instead dissecting how these relationships were engineered.
Looking at the choices, or, the lack of choices that were presented to these women and their families.
We have a challenging, but I think a really crucial set of sources today. We're examining specific historical accounts that, while they seem to reveal a blueprint of coercion,
Things like the documented experiences of young women like Helen Mar Kimball, the very vulnerable situation of the Lawrence sisters.
and the extreme deception surrounding Sarah Ann Whitney. I mean, these cases show these recurring strategies over and over.
It's always the invocation of absolute divine command, the targeting of some kind of profound vulnerability, and then this intense, calculated layer of secrecy.
A secrecy designed to bypass, both community standards and, crucially, Emma Smith's authority.
So for you, the listener, the goal isn't just to absorb facts, it's to understand the systemic operation of what you could call unrighteous dominion. We're looking to connect the theological justifications.
Like eternal exaltation.
Exactly. Connecting that to the very human and often tragic operational tactics that were used on the ground. And this requires a measured analytical tone. We have to let the specific details in the record guide our conclusions.
And the place to start, I think, logically, is with the theological document that created the whole apparatus for this, which brings us directly to the foundational threat, Doctrine and Covenants, section 132.
Okay, so if we're going to understand coercion, we first have to understand the stakes. And D&C 132, it establishes this absolute cosmic ultimatum.
One that fundamentally clashes with, the core theological concept of free agency.
Right. For anyone following this topic, you know that free agency is paramount in the theology. The ability to choose good or evil, it's essential for eternal progression.
Yet when we look at the choices presented within this section, specifically, the verses about the new and everlasting covenant, agency just seems to be completely overridden by this existential threat.
That's the question, isn't it? Can a choice truly be free when the consequence of saying no is, well, annihilation?
It's a central ethical dilemma that's just embedded right in the text.
It is. And the word destroyed, or some version of it, is used a staggering 11 times in D&C 132, specifically regarding the consequences of refusing to comply with this covenant.
Wow, 11 times.
11. And this isn't just about a personal loss of blessings. It's a prophetic declaration that if you don't comply, the gates of heaven close. You lose salvation for your entire family line, your kindred.
So think about that. If you, the listener, are presented with a choice where the alternative is the eternal destruction and damnation of your parents, your siblings, everyone related to you, is that truly an act of free will?
It's hard to see how. It transforms the decision from a personal choice into this life or death eternal responsibility for your entire lineage.
It's arguably the most potent form of spiritual leverage imaginable.
And it's applied directly against the deepest theological convictions of these early saints.
And this leverage doesn't just apply to the men being commanded to practice it, right? It's used on the women and their families to ensure they comply.
Absolutely. If a young woman is told that her refusal to enter this covenant jeopardizes her father's priesthood standing or her mother's exaltation, that perceived obligation becomes overwhelming.
To understand that power dynamic even further, we have to talk about how D&C 132 actually framed women within this whole covenant.
Yes, we have to look at the language.
Specifically, the recurring use of the word given.
The frequent use of given, it really suggests a specific transactional role for the women or girls entering the system.
It positions them less as autonomous agents.
And more as property, or instruments subject to priesthood authority. It's this external hierarchical transaction being governed by revelation, not some internal mutual agreement.
And that language aligns, I mean, pretty uncomfortably with the legal realities of the 19th century. Women were often legally seen as the property of their fathers or husbands.
So when D&C 132 uses this language of being taken and given, it reflects that structure. It places the spiritual legitimacy of the relationship entirely under the control of male authority figures. It echoes the patriarchal norms of the time.
But elevates them to cosmic law.
Exactly. And we see this spelled out explicitly in DNC 132, verse 44.
What does that one say?
The passage details Joseph Smith's claimed authority. It says, I reveal it unto you, my servant Joseph. Then shall you have power by the power of the holy priesthood to take her and give her unto him that hath not committed adultery.
That verse is startling in its clarity. It establishes the prophet's role as the central arbiter who determines who is worthy to receive a wife and who is worthy to be received.
The agency of the woman is just completely subsumed by the power of the holy priesthood.
The woman is the resource, basically, managed and allocated based on the faithfulness of the man.
And this entire doctrine, of course, is presented as a restoration. It's linked explicitly back to the patriarch Abraham,
which emphasizes the necessity of multiplying seed procreation as like a prerequisite for exaltation.
Right. DNC 132 mentions Abraham 31 times. It's constantly connecting polygamy directly to this concept of multiplying seed, both in this life and the next.
And that's a critical point, isn't it? It reinforces that conjugal relations and therefore procreation were core non-negotiable requirements.
It directly contradicts later apologetics that some of these early or very young marriages were just non-consummated, eternity-only sealings.
Yes. And this is where we have to introduce the historical context of the angel with the drawn sword narrative.
That narrative served as Joseph's ultimate lever for action. The accounts we have indicate Joseph was reportedly chastised by an angel threatening him with destruction.
Not for practicing polygamy in secret.
No, but for not practicing the commandment fully.
Fully. So what does that word imply here?
It implies that Joseph was perhaps trying to satisfy the command with just spiritual sealings or non-consummated relationships. Maybe hoping to placate Emma while still technically obeying.
But the angel's threat, the drawn sword, reinforced that procreation and conjugal relations were considered core requirements.
The consequence for not having sexual relations was destruction.
So if the prophet himself, who held the keys, was being threatened for, what, inadequate compliance?
Then every subsequent action taken to bring young women into the covenant must be understood as fulfilling that explicit full requirement to raise up seed. This theological framework not only gave Joseph the spiritual right to the woman,
it imposed an absolute obligation on him to consummate the marriage. And that context is absolutely essential when we start looking at the ages of the women who subsequently became his plural wives.
Right.
Okay, so if DNC 132 provided the eternal threat, the cosmic justification, then the cases of the Lawrence sisters, well, they show us the earthly mechanism used to identify and target profound vulnerability.
This is where the theoretical coercion became operational.
Yes.
The circumstances surrounding the entry of Maria and Sarah Lawrence into the Smith household, they established this undeniable power imbalance.
Their father died.
Right. And both sisters, Maria, who was 19, and Sarah, who was just 16, they moved into the Smith residence. That places them directly under the care and authority of Joseph and Emma.
And crucially, the sources are clear that Joseph Smith assumed the role of their legal guardian. This is a detail that we just cannot overstate.
I agree. This was not a prophet simply taking a ward into his home. This was a legal guardian marrying a 16-year-old under his direct legal, moral, and financial supervision.
In the 1840s, a legal guardianship established a relationship that was, it was akin to a foster child situation.
It granted Joseph extraordinary legal leverage and moral authority over their lives and their future. The law was on his side regarding their custody and care.
And we know from later accounts from both sisters that they indicated they had a sexual relationship with Joseph.
Yes. So the ethical implications of a legal guardian using his position to marry and then engage in sexual relations with his underage ward, regardless of the 19th century context, they are profound.
The situation gets even more complex when we connect this guardianship to a significant financial incentive.
This is where the intertwining of sexual power and financial gain becomes brutally apparent.
We have to look at the controversy surrounding the Lawrence sisters' inheritance, which is considerable.
Well, the precise details are subject to conflicting accounts, which is, common in these kinds of clandestine financial dealings.
William Law, who was a contemporary insider and later became Joseph's bitter enemy.
The publisher of the Novo Expositor.
Right. He claimed the inheritance was substantial, something like $8,000 in English gold.
But even if we take the lower, more established figure cited by historians like Todd Compton, a farm and a promissory note for $3,000,
right,
we need to appreciate the true value of that.
Okay, so what's that in today's money?
$3,000 in 1840 translates to approximately $102,000 today.
Wow.
For the early church, which was constantly, you know, financially strapped after the Kirtland banking failures and struggling to fund Nauvoo's construction, this wasn't just personal wealth. This was significant institutional capital.
So the question then becomes, was the primary goal the eternal ceiling, or was the inheritance a potent secondary or even primary motivator?
Regardless of the specific motivation, the control over the estate cemented Joseph's total power. And this was highlighted when the sister's mother remarried.
Her new husband, Josiah Butterfield, tried to recover the funds held in trust by Joseph.
Yes, and Joseph Smith's response, recorded in church history sources, shows his aggressive refusal to relinquish control. He claimed he kicked him out of the house across the yard and into the street.
That's a violent reaction to a legal attempt to recover his ward's assets. It really underscores the absolute control Joseph was seeking.
It extended beyond spiritual and emotional authority into outright financial dominion. The sisters were entirely dependent on him, economically and spiritually.
And this systemic control, well, sadly, it led to really tragic outcomes for the sisters.
Maria died young, only 22. Her health just deteriorated rapidly after Joseph's death.
And there's an account from a Mary Norman that attributes her death not just to consumption,
but more truthfully, of a broken heart.
That detail just resonates so deeply. Maria was quoted as saying, "My yoke has not been easy, nor my burden light."
Which suggests profound suffering tied directly to the reality of her marriage experience as a ward of the prophet.
A short, painful life. It starkly contrasts with the promises of joy and eternal exaltation that were associated with the covenant.
And Sarah Lawrence's story illustrates just how difficult it was to break free from the system. After Joseph's death, she was reassigned to Heber C. Kimball, but she eventually left the church around 1851.
And she later denied, emphatically, ever having been connected to Joseph or Kimball. She tried to erase that painful chapter from her life.
And this act of denial, it triggered an immediate punitive response from the faithful community.
Helen Mar Kimball, who we'll talk about next, she remained loyal to the system, and she publicly defamed Sarah in an article for the Woman's Exponent.
She called her wicked and a vicious and heartless woman for speaking out or denying the practice.
And that's a critical pattern, isn't it? Dissenters who reveal the painful reality of their experiences are immediately targeted, dehumanized, and discredited. It ensures the official narrative remains unchallenged.
So moving from the targeting of orphans to, well, the securing of powerful allies, we have to turn to the case of Helen Mar Kimball.
This highlights the Abrahamic test tactic. It's a calculated move designed to secure the absolute loyalty and complicity of influential male followers.
Creating a kind of dynastic allegiance.
Right. And Helen Mar Kimball was sealed to Joseph Smith several months before her 15th birthday. So she was 14 years old. Joseph was 38.
But the proposal wasn't just about Helen. It was the culmination of a larger, much more severe loyalty test that was imposed upon her father, Heber C. Kimball.
One of the 12 apostles.
Yes. Joseph Smith initially demanded that Heber sacrifice his first and only wife, the light.
And the sources document the immense psychological toll this took on Heber.
He reportedly wept days over the command. This demand was likely a test of ultimate obedience, probably not a genuine desire for Velite.
So the test's function was to break Heber's primary loyalty to his own marriage and family.
And reestablish his ultimate unquestioning allegiance to Joseph Smith as God's representative on earth. Heber only found relief after Velite had a profound spiritual vision and agreed to the principle, subsequently consenting for him to take a plural wife, Sarah Noon.
So having demonstrated his willingness to sacrifice his deepest earthly relationship, Heber was then ripe for the next equally painful step.
Sacrificing his own daughter, Helen. Helen's sealing to Joseph was the ultimate price paid, and it solidified a dynastic bargain that bound the Kimball family to the highest spiritual authority.
And the language Joseph used was just meticulously calibrated to exploit this deep belief in eternal family progression.
Yes, Helen Mar recorded the specific promise Joseph offered her. She wrote, he said, "If you will take this step, it will ensure your eternal salvation and exaltation, and that of your father's household and all your kindred."
That quote just reveals the core of the coercion.
It does. Helen was positioned as a literal savior figure for her entire family line. She saw herself, and she said this in her own words, as a willing sacrifice to purchase so glorious a reward.
So it wasn't about her own desire. It was about this crushing responsibility for the cosmic fate of everyone she loved.
And her mother, Velate, saw the anguish of the situation so clearly. Velate stated, "None but God and his angels could see my mother's bleeding heart when Joseph asked her if she was willing."
The mother foresaw the misery and conflict this arrangement would bring, but She ultimately felt forced to relent to the authority.
It's a devastatingly effective use of eternal threats against parental love.
And the tragic irony here only deepens when we look at the aftermath. This doctrine, which was intended to unite families for eternity, it resulted in the deliberate, eternal separation of Helen from her future spouse and children.
That's the key. Because Helen was sealed to Joseph for eternity, a sealing that superseded all earthly marriages. Her future children, with her eventual husband, Horace Whitney.
They would be considered Josephs in the eternities. Think about that for a second. That profound metaphysical separation, an earthly family raising children who in the next life belong to another man entirely.
This is the core of what we call the sealings paradox. It's a nonsensical yet tragically real doctrinal consequence that elevated the prophet's dynastic sealings above the emotional and biological reality of the surviving family unit.
And Horace Whitney, Helen's husband, he was sealed to a deceased woman, Caroline Whitney, the very next day.
Right, this consolation prize.
So we should spend a moment on that. Why seal him to a dead woman? It wasn't just a random act.
No, it was a theological mechanism. It was designed to provide him with a kingdom in the eternities. He was granted a wife, albeit a deceased one, so that he could still potentially preside over a family unit in the celestial kingdom.
Compensating him for the eternal loss of his biological children to Joseph Smith's lineage?
The contrast is just so stark. The reward promised to Helen was the exaltation of her family. The practical result was a life of emotional duress and a permanent, eternal fracturing of her immediate family unit.
The tactical use of these sealings prioritized the prophet's eternal domain above the welfare and unity of his followers' earthly and spiritual families. So the necessity of maintaining these dynastic sealings, while at the same time managing public opinion and Emma Smith's fierce opposition, it drove Joseph Smith to ever more extreme measures of secrecy.
And outright theatrical deception.
Yes. The case of Sarah Ann Whitney, the 17-year-old daughter of Bishop Newell K. Whitney, is the clearest illustration of this tactic.
The initial hurdle was just getting parental consent from Bishop Whitney and his wife. They were prominent, respected members of the community, and close friends of the Smiths.
And they initially resisted the marriage, which demonstrates that even loyalists had moral reservations about the practice, especially when it involved their own daughter.
So once again, Joseph deployed the highest level of spiritual threat. The parents agreed only after Joseph used the angel with the drawn sword story, threatening not just their destruction, but claiming his own destruction if the command was not obeyed immediately.
So he framed their compliance as the sole determinant of his continued life and prophetic ministry.
Exactly. And immediately following their compliance, the secrecy tactics went into high gear. Joseph feared Sarah Ann's brother, Horace Whitney, would disapprove.
Horace was a strong advocate and family protector.
So Joseph immediately dispatched Horace on a mission to the East before the marriage ceremony took place.
Effectively isolating Sarah Ann from a critical family advocate at the moment she needed one most.
And this pattern of isolating the target from potential protectors is a signature element of the overall tactic.
The operational reality of this deception is documented in Joseph's famous letter to the Whitney family, written while he was in hiding in late 1842.
That letter is so critical because it moves beyond theological justification. It details the specific calculated security protocols required to sustain the secret relationship.
Joseph immediately asked the family to burn the letter.
Right, which indicates the extreme risk of disclosure. He instructed them to visit only when Emma is gone to ensure most perfect safety.
We can dissect the language there. Why did a visit need perfect safety?
Because the purpose was likely not a spiritual lesson, but conjugal access, which would trigger Emma's wrath.
And he used language that was at once spiritual and deeply personal. He emphasized his loneliness and his desire to visit to get the fullness of my blessings sealed upon our heads.
But the subsequent warning provided the necessary context. The only thing to be careful of is to find out when Emma comes, then you cannot be safe.
This detail just highlights the inherent conflict between the prophetic command and the reality of his own marriage. His highest eternal blessing was dependent on actively hiding his actions from the wife he was sealed to for time and eternity.
The prophet was forced to become an active manager of risk and deception to practice his own doctrine.
And the lengths he went to maintain secrecy? Well, they culminated in this dramatic sham marriage tactic. He created a theatrical lie designed to shield his relationship with Sarah Ann from the community.
And most importantly, from Emma.
Yes.
Joseph staged a fake wedding between Sarah Ann and Joseph Kingsbury, a trusted friend. K. Kingsbury was to live in the Whitney home as Sarah Ann's supposed husband, providing public cover.
Just think of the psychological toll on both Sarah Ann and Kingsbury being forced to participate in this long-term intimate deception.
What's fascinating and disturbing is the mechanism Joseph used to secure Kingsbury's complicity.
Kingsbury was recently widowed,
deeply mourning his deceased wife, Caroline. And Joseph exploited this emotional vulnerability, offering the ultimate theological reward.
So in exchange for acting as the stooge in this deception,
Joseph promised Kingsbury a great glory, honor, and eternal lives, and specifically that he could claim his deceased wife, Caroline, in the first resurrection, ensuring no one have power to take her from me.
That just shows the immense power of the prophet to leverage the deepest human emotion grief for organizational control.
Kingsbury, willing to do almost anything to ensure his eternal reunion with Caroline, he committed to a public lie that compromised his personal integrity for years.
And we know the sham marriage was purely tactical because after Joseph's death, Sarah Ann was sealed to Heber C. Kimball, not Kingsbury.
Which demonstrates that the relationship was never intended to be real. Kingsbury was simply a tool used to facilitate Joseph's clandestine relationship with Sarah Ann Whitney while keeping Emma and the Nauvoo public at bay.
So all of these clandestine relationships and elaborate deception tactics were happening in the shadow of Joseph Smith's primary marriage, and they provoked a fierce, sophisticated political resistance from Emma Smith.
She understood the mechanism of coercion better than anyone, and she sought to dismantle it using her only real power base, the Relief Society.
The Relief Society, founded in 1842, it provided Emma with a powerful platform.
And she attempted to use this position to assert control over the moral discourse surrounding marriage and relationships. She was pushing back against the growing spiritual wifery that she knew was infiltrating Nauvoo.
And we see her strategy so clearly in how she edited Joseph's own statements.
Joseph drafted a statement to be read to the Relief Society on March 31, 1842, warning against secret relationships. His original statement, however, contained this critical loophole.
What was the loophole?
It condemns secret practices, unless it be by the message delivered to you by our own mouth, by actual revelation and commandment.
And Emma intentionally left out that entire loophole when she read the statement to the women.
It's a masterclass in political maneuvering. She knew Joseph used the authority of revelation and commandment to override women's moral objections.
So by deleting the clause, she was effectively trying to delegitimize his primary tool of spiritual coercion,
making all secret relationships appear condemned by the prophet himself.
But the deception had just run too deep by then. It had infiltrated the very heart of the Relief Society.
In October 1842, Emma led the Relief Society in signing a public statement denying that polygamy was practiced in the church.
And the profound betrayal Emma faced is just, it's visible in the list of signatories. This public denial statement was signed by women who were secretly married to Joseph Smith,
including her two counselors, Elizabeth Ann Whitney, Sarah Ann's mother, and Sarah Cleveland.
And her personal secretary, the poet Eliza Snow.
Imagine the depth of that personal toll. Not just the betrayal by her husband, but the betrayal by her closest female allies who were forced to participate in this calculated public lie.
They were literally signing a document that denied the reality of their own secret spiritual and physical commitments to the prophet.
And this political act just illustrates the crushing power of the system. The women who signed were clearly prioritizing obedience to the prophetic command.
Or maybe their own compromised ceilings.
Right, over loyalty to Emma and to the truth.
And the conflict between Emma and Joseph grew intensely personal and volatile.
William Clayton's journal entry from August 23, 1843, documents Joseph admitting he had intense difficulty with Emma. He stated he had to use harsh measures to put a stop to her abuse,
which showcases the extreme intensity and possibly physical nature of their private conflict.
The word abuse in the 19th century context often meant harsh language or verbal opposition, but the phrase harsh measures that suggests a level of force or control applied by Joseph to manage his wife's powerful and legitimate dissent.
Emma was fighting not just a doctrine, but the constant humiliating lying perpetrated by her husband and her closest friends, a psychological war that took an undeniable toll.
And Emma's resistance eventually led to the disorganization of the Relief Society for a decade. The organization, designed to provide a platform for female agency, became a threat to the prophet's secret practices.
So it was suppressed until after the saints moved west.
So when we synthesize these specific case studies, the manipulation of theology, the targeting of the vulnerable, the financial coercion, the Abrahamic tests, the theatrical secrecy, We move past isolated incidents.
And we identify a clear, systematic, and destructive pattern of behavior.
Right. And this pattern aligns disturbingly well with what behavioral analysts today define as grooming.
It's a predatory strategy used to establish emotional ties and systemic control before introducing sexual demands. We can map the historical actions directly onto the defined steps.
Okay, so first, the targeting of vulnerable individuals. We saw this with the Lawrence sisters, who were orphans living in the Smith home, directly under his legal and emotional guardianship.
Second, befriending the family or parents and gaining complicity. The Abrahamic test on Heber C. Timbal and the spiritual threats levied against the Whitney family were calculated means of gaining parental consent through cosmic coercion.
Third, establishing an emotional or spiritual connection. Joseph used his status as prophet of God to imbue the proposals with divine authority, which overrode all normal moral checks and balances.
Fourth, gaining complicity via bargaining. The offering of eternal exaltation for Helen Mar Kimball's entire kindred and the promise to Kingsbury that he could secure his deceased wife. Those were transactions that leveraged the deepest hopes and fears of his followers.
And finally, isolating the target. Joseph sent Horace Whitney on a mission and enforced extreme secrecy with Sarah Ann, forbidding her from being seen with him publicly and demanding clandestine visits when Emma was absent.
These were not just historical anomalies. They were systematic uses of authority targeting the most defenseless, the vulnerable, the faithful, and the emotionally bereaved.
And it is absolutely essential to emphasize that these tactics were not universally accepted, even in the 19th century context. We saw immediate condemnation from contemporaries.
Insiders like William Law, a close friend and trusted member, he broke ranks precisely because of the secrecy and the coercion involved in these plural marriages.
Which led directly to the publication of the Nauvoo Expositor. This demonstrates that even those living under the social norms of the time recognized these actions as a gross abuse of power.
This entire analytical deep dive must ultimately lead us back to a profound irony contained within Jason Smith's own recorded revelations.
A passage often taught as the definitive warning against abuse of authority. DNC 121.39 contains a quote where Joseph states, "We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion."
That passage is meant to be a divine indictment of human weakness and pride. Yet the detailed historical accounts we have just explored, the threats, the bargaining, the deception, the financial coercion, the isolation, the force used against Emma, they read as a chilling, step-by-step illustration of unrighteous dominion.
Being exercised by the highest authority in the church, in direct contradiction of the ethical principles taught elsewhere in the Revelations. So to summarize our deep dive, we have meticulously illuminated how systematic spiritual authority and emotional coercion were deployed to override the agency of young women and their families in Nauvoo.
The recurring patterns show a calculated effort to secure dynastic ceilings and sexual access, often at the direct expense of individual moral freedom and the established family structure.
And this analysis leaves us with a potent historical and ethical conundrum. If the ultimate goal of the new and everlasting covenant was, as claimed, to unite families for eternity and ensure the highest possible exaltation,
we have to wrestle with this final provocative thought. What does it say about the inherent structure of the doctrine that its implementation often required the deliberate eternal separation of families?
As tragically demonstrated in the case of Helen Mar Kimball, whose children belong to Joseph, leaving her earthly husband, Horace Whitney, to be sealed to a deceased woman as a compensation prize.
We encourage you to continue your own research into these primary accounts and look at the source material with fresh analytical eyes. Thank you for engaging in this important discussion and for demanding the depth that this topic warrants.
We'll catch you on the next deep dive.